Support for KPLU comes from the Museum of Flight, all year celebrating 100 years of Boeing innovations and the Seattle culture, with live performances and new exhibits monthly. Details at museumofflight.org.
We have an amazing gentleman with us today. Please welcome to our KPLU studios, Abdullah Ibrahim. Woo-hoo! Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm just completely enraptured. Abdullah Ibrahim is our guest today in our studio session. And do you need headphones or something for the interview? Okay, good deal. And I'll tell you what, I just feel like it's Christmas and my birthday and everything to be here in this room with you. And I think more than any musician that I can think of, you really embody a citizen of the world in your living in South Africa and in Switzerland, in New York, and you know, really bringing this message of the music that you helped, I think, distill in South Africa with the music that you were playing. And in researching for you being here, I didn't know about the Duke Ellington connection, that Duke Ellington actually said, met you. Mm-hmm. He came to see you at a gig in Switzerland. And how was that? Because he asked you to sit in for him a couple times. It was like he couldn't be there. It's so anyone that could, Duke Ellington could replace Duke Ellington is amazing. You know, that's, you just don't think that happens. But how did that happen with Duke?
Well, Ellington, like several of our, many of our other elders, we still regarded Ellington not as a jazz musician, but as an elder in the community. The wise old man that you go and get wisdom from, hopefully. So, a jazz musician, you're part of the groundwork that you have to do is research and play Ellington. It's a must. Ellington, I think, more than any other musician that I can think of, really had such a massive impact, not just on jazz, but just on music. It's going in totally another direction. And it has never really been quite acknowledged. Those of us who were close to him and the band, the band was actually his instrument, on a daily basis, it was incredible what had happened and at what level conceptually and musically this whole, you know, he was. And of course there was this relationship that he had with Billy Strayhorn. And Billy Strayhorn was, I mean, you know the song Lush Life. He wrote the song when he was 16 years of age. And jazz musicians were struggling with it. Well, we were playing in a club in Zurich. We just come out of South Africa. And so Satima, we married and she passed away last year. The club owner didn't want to let us go because Ellington was playing at a concert in Zurich. And this is where we met a lot of musicians because they were coming through on concerts. Jazz Messengers, Ella, the Basie Orchestra, Max Roach and Abby Lincoln. So we wanted so much to go and see Ellington, but the club owner didn't want to let us go. But Satima went to the concert, and we were just about closing up the club when she arrived with Ellington and the whole entourage. We don't know today what she told him. And the club owner had to reopen the club. And he asked us to play. We played a couple of songs. And then the next day he took us to Paris.
Wow.
For the recording, because that was he was A&R man for Reprise Records, which was Frank Sinatra's record label. So we went to Paris and recorded with the trio. And at the same session, they also recorded. Because when we got to the studio, he asked Satima, I said, so what do you do? And she said, I sing. I said, okay, we'll start with you. So it was something else, almost like psychic in some way. And so she with Billy, with myself accompanying her, with Ellington and also Strayhorn accompanying her. But that record was never released until many years after. So, yeah, so it was quite a highlight of our life to meet Ellington and then to have this relationship afterwards and learn from him. Not so much about music, but what this was all about.
Yeah. And I'd love to talk to you in a little bit about how you've been continuing in your own role as elder to the community and in teaching and in bringing people along and what you're doing on your farm. But can we hear another song first?
A little.
Another song first, and then we'll come back and talk sure. about the farm and the astrophysicists. And okay. It's good stuff. Abdullah Ibrahim in our studio session. Abdullah Ibrahim is our guest on our studio session today. I think that what we were talking about, you have a very special concert coming up. You're going back to South Africa in June, mm-hmm. and it's going to be bringing together the your kind of your first jazz group that really had changed the perception of jazz in Africa at the time, 1959?
59, yeah.
Please tell us about, well, we just had Hugh Masekela in the studios in November, which was so wonderful. So it's great to have another great citizen of South Africa here. And Hugh Masekela is going to be at the shows coming up. Are you going to be reuniting that band? Or?
Yeah, and the 50s was a defining moment for us in South Africa. And politically, culturally, socially, because we started to understand that they are not our teachers. So when we took that step, and especially the young people, was the so-called Soweto Uprising, which came later. But in the 50s, there was this groundswell of understanding that we have to affirm our own identity instead of somebody telling us who we were or who we are. So I formed a group called Jazz Epistle, and it was some of the older musicians and some young musicians. Yuma Sikela was one of these people. This was in the 50s, late 50s. And we recorded an album. We called the group Jazz Epistle. Only one recording. But it was affirmation of our own heritage and also a political statement, because that was a time when there was a resolve that we needed to take charge of our own affairs. At that time, we were individually working on the traditional music of South Africa. You see, because we'd always been told that it was not marketable because it was decadent, because the point of reference was always Eurocentric.
Okay. You know?
So we started composing in our tradition, and of course, the system banned everything. They banned everything. But we are very resourceful young people, you know, these ones with no visible means of support, you know, who could access everything. So everything that was banned, we had it.
Some things never change.
Literature,
right?
Books, and music. And of course, then listening to records and also understanding there's a... Well, deeply inspired also by the struggle, the civil rights struggle, yeah. And we read everything. We also got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, the radio, listened to Joe Louis beat up people, go to dance out in the street. So when we formed this group, we said, well, we will record our own compositions, because hitherto it was not allowed. When you got into a studio, there was always somebody telling you what you should sound like. But at that same time, around, this was like late 50s, man, around the same time in the 60s, musicians, jazz musicians here in the United States were also affirming the African heritage. But also in South Africa, we affirmed the heritage, but we also had a non-traditional, non-conformist approach to the music, because we were listening to everything. You know, we were listening to European classical music. When I was 15 years of age, I studied Indian ragas and talas. And so we had this broad perspective. We didn't realize the impact that it had internationally, because when I came out to the United States, when I met Don Cherry, the first thing he said to me was Jazz Epistle and how it had influenced them too. And when I met Ornette, it was the same idea that we, ancient tradition, new relevance. So on June 16th, next month, we're doing a concert in Johannesburg, two concerts with Ekaya, some of my musicians. We're playing with me tonight. They're coming to South Africa, and Yuma Sikela, and we are acknowledging Jazz Epistle or some. We're redrafting the charts from the record. Mm-hmm. We're actually going to play it. But also June 16th is the Youth Day, which is a commemoration of the so-called Soweto Uprising, when the young people in South Africa protested against being taught in a foreign language, being taught in Afrikaans. So it is. So we're doing these two concerts. So it's almost like a creating or making a statement of the narrative of how the music and our resolution to be free from a restrictive government, how we celebrate this. This is going to be on June 16th.
Oh, that's beautiful. That was from the time of that recording. It was still over 30 years of apartheid going on, and you know the oppression of those voices that you were developing. And as you formed, you know, as you went back to your community, you brought children along too. You spread the knowledge and the information about the music and bringing people along. And now on your farm in South Africa, you told me about a group of astrophysicists that you have nurtured and who just graduated and are working with you on solar and technology and all kinds of wonderful things.
Yeah, the Kalahari, I think it was called the Green Kalahari, was my great-grandfather. Also, it was a tradition, but we were driven off the land. So a few years ago, I saw on the internet that there was a farm for sale. And it was dead cheap, so I bought it. But it's in the out of so-called nowhere. See? It was actually in what's called the Northern Cape, and it's called the Green Kalahari. So it's an 800-hectare farm. It's about 7 kilometers by 7 by 5. And have a unique underground water system, unique underwater delta system, which runs under the farm. So, you know? So we have springbok and ostriches, and everything grows there. You know, grapes and oranges. So we're going to be self-sufficient. The about 2 hours, one and a half hours drive east, they have created the SKA program, the Square Kilometer Array program, which is the radio telescope that looks into the universe. So we competed with Australia for this project, and we won it. So they've been actively engaged in this, and last year they graduated about 170 young astrophysicists. So what we're doing is, so we have the tourism on board, we have arts and culture on board, so we create an academy and something that is also self-sufficient. Next to us, we're on the border of Namibia and Botswana. But in Namibia, one of the most potent income project is astrotourism. And people come and gaze at the stars. So we are locked in our farm with the SKA program and setting up astrotourism.
That's so
but
wonderful.
But once you have tourism and we have music involved, and also we are self-sufficient in terms of feeding ourselves. We have then access to cutting-edge technology. And so, in fact, my young people, the team are right now at this point on the farm. Yeah, so we think perhaps this will get the people out of the city. You know?
That's always a good thing. Always a good thing. I want to look back in your Manenberg, the song that kind of became the unofficial anthem in South Africa for the young people. Were you surprised by that reception of it?
It took us by surprise. It was at the time it was brutal. And we were shooting young people and imprisoning people, torturing them. In the road where I lived, on the corner, there was something called the Trojan Horse Incident, where the police actually got on the back of a truck and boarded it up and then hid themselves and then opened fire. And the young people killed them. It was on the corner. So this was, so my family and my kids and the people were all involved with this, you see. So then we have a little record company. And I have a little record shop in Johannesburg. And in Cape Town, because all the musicians were based in Cape Town, we said, okay, we're gonna do a recording. So we went into the studio, and I had written about five compositions and arrangements that we were going to play. Right? And during the intermission, I was recording on a grand piano. And in the intermission, I saw this old upright piano standing in the corner. And I went over to the corner, and the first thing, but what was unique about this instrument is what they used to do. They put drawing pins on the hammer. You see, the hammer hits like this against the string. So they put drawing pins on the end of the hammer, so when it hits the string, it sounds like a harpsichord. So this is what this unique sound that you hear, right? But the first thing I played was, and the horns. I said, yeah, the horns. They picked it up, and the drummer and bass player. And they said, okay, we need a bridge. So we said, that was the bridge, and we repeated. And then we just played, everybody played solos, but it was a 17-minute take. And so, luckily, the engineer was hip. You know, he recorded it. So we went back into the studio to continue with what I had written. And they said, wait a minute, something had happened here. Let us listen to the playback. And when we listened to the playback, it was, we were free. Because what we didn't realize that the affirmation of our own music. You know, the horn players never played solos like that before. And on an extended 17 minutes.
Wow.
And so we said, but, so what is the song? You know, and we understood that we had captured the moment, you know, of the uprising, of the young people being shot down. You know. Mm. And of course, one of the, it's called the Soweto Uprising. This happened in Soweto, but this happened in townships all over South Africa. And Manenberg was in Cape Town. Manenberg was one of the first townships when people were forcibly removed from Cape Town's center. They were thrown into these horrible places, Manenberg. So we dedicated the song to Manenberg. We went to all the record companies, and nobody wanted it. Now, firstly, you're going to say, well, how are you going to get airplay for 17 right. minutes? So we have a little record shop in Johannesburg. It's close to the bus terminus. All the buses coming from Soweto. So it's a center of action, right? We have a little record shop. So we decided, okay, we're just going to press some records. So we pressed LPs. We put them in covers and played the music over the loudspeakers. We sold 20,000. In 2 weeks.
Wow.
it was incredible because the people responded to it. The people responded because it was the mood of affirmation, mm-hmm. and something to say, look, we affirm who we are. There were many stories around what happened. The bus terminus, there were these two, one person was blind, and the other one was physically challenged, and they used to, well, they became sort of a, like fixtures at the bus terminus. You know, everybody knew them. They would come in the morning and come, you know, do their thing. So one day they walked past the shop, and they heard the music, and they came inside. This blind one is leading. So they asked him, what is that? And they said, what is this, Manenberg? And The next morning when we came to open the shop, they were there with the money to buy.
And it just completely captured the world then from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. Can we have one more song?
Sure.
Thank you. Abdullah Ibrahim is our guest in our studio session today, and we have time for another song.